Hey, football fans, Drew Brees here. Kroger Play and Owner's Box have teamed up for the next generation of daily fantasy sports. First-time players can get $25 in free entries, plus 250 fuel points. And you can score all season long with 2x the fuel points for every dollar spent to use at Kroger Fuel Centers. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER.
Void where prohibited. Eligibility restrictions apply. 18 plus in most eligible states, but age varies by jurisdiction. Offer is valid between 8/6/25 and 1/5/26. Terms apply. See full terms and conditions at ownersbox.com/footballfuelpointstc.
This week, could Jim Gavin win the presidential election? And what happens if he does? Let me explain.
Let me explain with Sean Defoe, a News Talk original.
Hello and welcome to Let Me Explain. And don't forget to subscribe and like wherever it is you're listening. And also check out some of the other podcasts that News Talk is doing at the moment, including Calling It with myself and Ivan Yates, which has caused a little bit of controversy, I think it's fair to say, in the first couple of weeks of this election campaign. New episode out today along with Let Me Explain, but today we're trying to get facts and we are talking to Justice Marie Baker. She's the chair of the Electoral Commission and so is at least in part responsible for looking after this election, even though it's the Department of Housing that runs it. The Electoral Commission heavily involved. And we sat down in Dublin Castle this week to discuss the powers of the president. What can he say and actually not say, he or she, when they actually get into office? And what happens in this unprecedented situation we have now, where it is the case that Jim Gavin will be on your ballot paper? You will be able to vote for him, but he's actively stopped campaigning. So this is Let Me Explain, and this is my chat with Justice Marie Baker. Listen, thank you so much for coming on to the Let Me Explain podcast, particularly at the moment when everything is as busy as it is. And look, we might start with what was the big news, what probably will be remembered as the big news of this election, and that is Jim Gavin and Jim Gavin pulling out of the campaign, but of course not really being able to pull out of the campaign because of the way the legislation is. So people for who are going in on the 24th, they are going to see him on the ballot.
They are going to see him on the ballot because there are three candidates. There are three candidates in this election by law, by the statute. And the statute provides the process by which a candidate is nominated. You have to go through all the stages. And the Act says once a candidate stands nominated, that nominated candidate appears on the ballot paper. So we have three candidates, one of whom has stopped campaigning. And that person has effectively, by not campaigning, indicated in his language that he doesn't intend to take up the office. So there are three candidates, and people in the secrecy and privacy of the ballot may vote whichever way they like.
And a lot of people are saying that they are going to do that for their own reasons, be it mischief or divilment or a protest vote or whatever. So what happens to those votes? They're counted as normal votes, are they?
Yes, so the word mischief is interesting there. But voting for any one of those three candidates is a valid vote, provided you express your preference. You must express your number one preference in order to have a valid vote. And the Act is clear as to how you can not have a valid vote if you don't have a number one, or if you have two number ones, or if you sign the ballot paper or don't do anything with it, then that's a spoiled or invalid vote. But a vote for any one of those three candidates is a valid vote. And this is pure system. So a vote for a number one for a candidate who doesn't reach the quota and who is the lowest, who has the lowest number of votes, will be distributed to the number two. That's how PR works. So it's an effective vote to vote for any one of the three of them. It's an effective vote to get given number two or number three, which probably won't count in this case, but a number one or a number two for any one of the three candidates.
So we might come back to the possibilities and ramifications of Jim Gavin, but just to pick up on that point. So because there were some changes in the law here a few years ago, weren't there, about expressed preference? So if you go in and you put, say, an X next to just one candidate, but don't put any other, is that counted? Is that valid?
The purpose of the amendment in the legislation was to, as far as possible, give effect to each ballot paper. So if all you do is put a one, a two, a three, then you're doing what as where. That's the best way.
The gold standard.
The gold standard. But if what you do is just put an X beside one person, then the returning officer is entitled to consider that to be a number one. What happens there is there's no obvious number two. But if you put two X's, then there's no way for the returning officer to ascertain who was your number one. So the purpose of the amending legislation really was to try and give effect to every vote insofar as it could be done. And, you know, you sometimes see at a polling station, you see arguments going on in the ballot paper being stood up to the light to see what people are saying about it, because the vote is public to that extent. Debate sometimes as to valid or invalid polls is done in public. And you see the lawyers, usually lawyers, hanging around saying yes or no to the acceptance of a particular.
Okay, so as long as you have a clear preference, everyone will do their best to make that.
It's more than that. It's as long as you have a clear number one.
Okay, right. Then
preferences, as long as you have a clear number one, you can't have two number ones.
Anymore. Yes, yeah. You can't. Or if you write good guy, less good guy, worst guy, you know, I have seen ballots that have something akin to that in the past.
And I've heard probably anecdotal evidence of people saying, you know, I like whoever. Marie Baker, and that's my preference. Well, maybe a returning officer would say, well, that's a vote for her, but maybe not. I mean, it depends on what words are used. Really, Irish people are sophisticated electors. Really, Irish people, even those who are just beginning to vote and voting for the first time, know what number one looks like.
So just make sure you don't accidentally spoil your vote.
Don't accidentally spoil your vote, I think, is a very important message. But what you do in the privacy of the vote is your choice after that.
Mm. So to go back to the candidate who has stopped campaigning, can he win?
If he gets the most votes, he is the president-elect under the Act. So he has been declared to be the winner of the poll, and he is deemed for that purpose to be the president-elect. And then there's a process by which the returning officer sends a letter to that candidate and to the Taoiseach, the government, etc., a long list of people, identifying the winner. So, yes, one of those three people will be the winner, whoever it is.
And after that letter is issued, do they have to accept whoever the candidate is?
To take upon yourself the office of president, you must swear in front of the people of Ireland that you will uphold the constitution and do your job. So there is a formal oath in the constitution, and that must be taken by a person to become president. The word used in the constitution is enter upon the office of president. And that, of course, doesn't happen until the current president retires, which is on the 10th of November. And usually we try and have the swearing-in ceremony or the taking of the oath the day after or thereabouts.
Yeah.
The last one, I think, was, in fact, exactly in that basis. It was on a Sunday.
Yes.
Yeah.
And so in theory, even though this person has stopped campaigning, that he could still decide, oh, the people have elected me. Actually, yes, I shall take it and be your president for the next 7 years.
Well, whoever is, after the count has been had and the poll has been had, whoever is number one will be deemed to be the president-elect for that purpose.
And what happens then if, in this hypothetical scenario, an unlikely scenario, let's be honest, that Jim Gavin were to win, and he says, no, I bowed out of the campaign, I made it clear I wasn't going to take it up. What happens then? Does it go to second preference? Do we rerun?
That's a great question. Actually, I hadn't heard it asked, but no, it doesn't go to number two. Quite simply, there is a declaration by the returning officer of who won the election. And if that person says the day after, or even on that day, or a week after, that he or she won't take up the job, as it were, it doesn't go to number two. There has to be another election. And the Constitution provides for the running of time, another 60 days. You know, the provision for it is a 60-day window year. And the Constitution provides for the time for that to happen. The Constitution provides for what should happen if the person who's elected dies. So it's the same. It would be the same process. 60 days after the person dies, 60 days, I suppose, after the person says they're not going to take up office.
Mm. And in this scenario, does everything reset to zero? No one has been nominated. You have to do the council route again or the Oireachtas route?
You do the whole thing again.
Okay. Yes. And a lot of people are saying they don't like these candidates. They're potentially going to vote for Jim Gavin in the hope that nominations will reopen and suddenly we have a whole slew of other candidates, which I suppose seems a very unlikely thing to me that you would suddenly get this whole bunch of other people coming in.
Well, I mean, I'm not a political pundit. I'm the chair of the Electoral Commission and I'm the lawyer. That's a political question, really. I mean, there are people who vote with particular intentions. What I would say is, if you vote with a particular intention and that doesn't result in the election of somebody, then I'm not sure whether you've achieved anything. So the use of your vote is something that the commission is concerned about, that people vote the way they want to vote and they express the view they want to express. And I suppose that's important for people to think.
And does that extend as far as spoiling your vote? Like, what's your thoughts on that?
Spoiling your vote is different now from voting for one of the three candidates. And the Act provides the way in which you spoil your vote, essentially not putting in a number one. And some of those are accidental. There is a tradition, a number of countries, including here, of writing things on the ballot paper. They are invalid votes. They do not count. And one thing I would say is spoiling a vote or creating an invalid vote doesn't elect anyone. It doesn't result in the election of one of the candidates. And also, why you spoil, if you indicate why you spoil or make it, or cast an invalid vote, it's not going to be apparent for a very long time until the Department of Housing analyses those spoiled votes, why you did. So all the spoiled votes are put together, all the rejected votes are put together in a bundle, they're counted, but they're not cashable. I think people possibly need to know that as well.
So if they go in and en masse say, I'm spoiling my vote because I wanted X or because there's not enough candidates, we're not actually going to know that until the heat of this election is well gone.
A long time afterwards, in fact, because the Department of Housing does do a survey of the voting patterns, the voting papers, etc. But on the day or in the days after, or even at the 60 days, I wouldn't anticipate that there would be any chance that the spoiled votes, if you want to call them that, are characterised or categorised in any way.
Okay, so the people who are thinking, I'm going to spoil my vote because I want to send a message to the government that I don't like the nomination process or that this election just didn't run how I wanted to run and doesn't represent me, probably need to consider how far that impact is going to go or not.
It won't either elect a candidate or prevent a candidate from being elected, if you understand me. Mm-hmm. So it won't elect one of the three, or it won't prevent one of those three from being elected. I think that's possibly what people need.
Okay. So let's talk about whoever does get elected, and indeed current presidents, and what's in the legislation in your bailiwick of what they can and can't do. But first, what they can and can't say is something I want to focus on, because I heard a lot of different people, presenters and commentators, etc., talking about Michael D. Higgins and how he's, in their terms, stretched the boundaries and pushed the boundaries. Is there very strict restrictions on what the president can actually say in public?
Well, first of all, this is found in the constitution, not in legislation. And that's important because this is how the people of Ireland chose to identify the powers and role of the president. Now, remember, the constitution is from 1937. And what's clear, very clear, is that the president has two powers of address. He or she can speak to the Oireachtas, the joint houses of the Oireachtas, or he or she can speak to the nation. But in both cases, the speech must be cleared by government effectively, must be approved by government. There is nothing in the Constitution that identifies any other role that the president may, any other speaking role that the president may have. And there is a very lively debate among academic writers and the writers who wrote the main text on the Constitution, Judge Gerard Hogan, Judge of the Supreme Court, and David Kenny, and the two other co-authors. This is Kelly on the Constitution, it's still called. It makes it clear, and this is really the authoritative text, that the Constitution does not mandate silence. But a lot of language has been used around this. Some of the commentators, say Conor O'Mahony from UCC, is fairly vocal on this. David Kenny in Trinity is very vocal on this. Oran Doyle has written about this. There's a long article, a long article by Sean Raisford and Jamie McLaughlin. They're from DCU, I should say. I apologise. And they say that the role has been not so much pushed, but has been identified in some way by previous presidents, by the last three presidents. And of course, one of the factors is that in the past, the president might have been some way visible, but what the president said wouldn't have been picked up, except when the president spoke vocally or publicly. But now, of course, presidents are, everything they say gets picked up on social media. They get picked up. They are more visible. That has been the case now for the last three presidents. They're much more visible. They're much more lively. I mean, I remember De Valera. I don't think I ever heard De Valera's voice. And I remember several presidents, obviously, given my age, for I don't remember their voices, but we all remember the voices of the three last presidents. So they have spoken and they've spoken differently. The expression that's been used in some of the literature is, do we have a Trappist monk in the Oris, or do we have somebody who in some way reflects upon principles and ideals, or some way reflects civic society? No, it's a tricky question, because remember, the president must be politically neutral. So a president isn't a decision maker, a lawmaker, or an influencer of the law in that sense.
Now, just on that politically neutral, is that written anywhere? Like, is that constitutional or legislation? Or
no,
is that just,
it's not. And in fact, I think the expression comes from Tom Hickey in DCU. I think that's his word. And in fact, the Supreme Court in the Right to Know case quoted that expression and said presidents are sometimes described as politically neutral. But that's politically neutral. It depends on what you mean by political. Mm-hmm. Certainly, a president should not, if the president is to hold authority on behalf of the people of Ireland, should not be party political in that sense, or shouldn't reflect current party political positions. Because after all, a president will be president for 7 years. That president, he or she may well span several governments. It'll certainly span at least one general election. So for the president to hold authority, the president must always appear to be above the political fray, mustn't appear to be biased or partisan. And even if you think of some of the ceremonial roles of the president, like appointing Taoiseach, appointing the judiciary, which are purely ceremonial, it's important that the president, whoever it is and however it evolves or has evolved, should appear politically neutral, objective, not in the political fray. And so what can a president say? A president can say what a president says within those constraints. And a president would always be conscious of not putting that sense of not being partisan, not being biased at risk. So the president will take his or her counsel as to how to do that.
Yeah, because it's a fine balance then, isn't it? And one that, if it is as much convention, and of course important in the way that you said it is, in that they have to deal with all parties and be the voice of the nation.
Not just deal with them, but appear to deal with them.
Yes.
It gives the clear impression that they are dealing as a non-partisan, non-biased person, non-politically biased person.
And I suppose that comes down then possibly to personal preference, does it? Whether someone wants a De Valera who they never heard, or who was very clearly of one camp but stayed out of the fray, or they want a Michael D. Higgins who has maybe pushed that further than any president we've seen so far, you could argue.
Yes, and it comes down to personal preference. It may come down to the world we live in. It may come down to what happens in the world in the next 7 years. It may come down to a lot of things. And it comes down to personality, possibly. Different presidents have different personality, have different, some of them will be introverted, some of them will be extroverted people, some of them operate well in the local area, some of them operate better in an academic area. Most of our presidents, going right back, have been thinkers, and they've expressed their thoughts. And so that's part of a personality as well. But you're right, it's a matter of choice.
So that's just interesting that it's not in the Constitution necessarily what they can say.
What's in the Constitution are the limitations on those, as it were, formal addresses to the nation or to the Oireachtas. What's in the Constitution about the power of the president to do things is very much clearer, because the president's powers are very constrained.
Yeah. So let's get into a few of those. So summoning the Dáil, for example, because we saw Conor McGregor and some of the other putative candidates say, I'm going to get the Dáil in and sort out housing on day one and all this. Was that all nonsense?
Well, I mean, I never use the word nonsense, really. But the fact of the matter is the president has no independent or personal authority to call the Dáil or to dissolve the Dáil or to do anything or to present legislation or require that a particular policy position be taken. Absolutely none. The president has some discretionary powers. They're not unimportant. They're absolutely not unimportant. One of them is the one that's most spoken about, is the power under Article 26 to refer legislation to the Supreme Court for its consideration of constitutionality. That has often been said in shorthand as being the president is protecting the Constitution. But in fact, the Supreme Court in the Right to Know case said the president is protecting the Constitution and the legislation. So the president is looking at legislation and making sure that it will pass a constitutional challenge, because the worst scenario, if you like, is that a piece of legislation is passed, decisions are made on the basis of that legislation, and the legislation is then struck down later. Then you have an unsatisfactory set of rights and obligations and results and decisions of the courts. So the president protects both the constitution and the legislation in its constitutionality. And that's a discretionary power. And the president must convene the Council of State, must hear their advice. But the president, as it were, takes all of that advice back to his or her office and decides himself or herself whether to refer. And the reference, I think the whole, I think everyone in Ireland probably knows this by now, the reference means if the Supreme Court says that the legislation or the particular provisions of the legislation, depending on the type of reference it is, have passed constitutional scrutiny, then that is the last time that legislation may be challenged. And that's probably important and has acted in some way as a constraint on the president exercising the Article 26 power. But presidents have done so 16 times now in the history of the state, so it's not insignificant. And the last one, in fact, I sat on it, was the judicial appointments legislation. And in a sense, it was an obvious one, because you can't imagine anybody who didn't get appointed under the new law actually raising their head upon the parapet, identifying themselves and saying, I didn't get appointed. Mm-hmm. That'd be unlikely. But more important than that, and that's about maybe that's just anecdotal thinking, but more importantly, that if that legislation had been challenged successfully, what is to happen about decisions made by judges who were appointed under a non-constitutional regime? So if the legislation fell in the course of a challenge, maybe in 5 years' time, would be very, very unsatisfactory. You'd have judges who had been appointed under legislation which fell. So in a sense, it was not as difficult to decide that. But there have been many cases where presidents have been asked to look at legislation. They've done so, they've considered it. The Supreme Court has held its breath and the president did not refer.
Mm. And the significance of that, maybe because I'm no better person to explain the significance of it, because, you know, looking at it from outside, is there a huge amount of difference between the president referring it over directly to the Supreme Court and someone who might in future take a challenge that ultimately could end up at the Supreme Court anyway?
Well, yes and no. I mean, first of all, it's only the Supreme Court that hears the Article 26 reference, so it doesn't go up through the system. Right. So the High Court working through some of the facts and making findings of facts or whatever. That's the first difference. The second difference is that a person who makes a challenge to legislation must do so on the basis of a particular problem or complaint that person has and has a direct interest in. So it might take 30 years before somebody emerged from the woodwork, as it were, with a problem. And also, the Supreme Court hearing an Article 26 reference does so in the most general way. I mean, obviously, the lawyers present the case, present possible examples. But it's a very difficult exercise, because lawyers function on the basis of usually, this is how our training is. We ask a question in the light of a particular set of facts, and then we apply the law. Whereas in an Article 26 reference straight to the Supreme Court, the Supreme Court is being asked general questions without a specific question or problem to solve. So it's a very different, very, very different exercise. Also, another thing that people don't think of is the Supreme Court must give a unanimous decision on an Article 26 reference.
Okay.
And that's an interesting thing as well, because sometimes if there's a challenge to legislation and it runs through the system from the High Court, maybe to the Court of Appeal and to the Supreme Court, there might be a dissenting judgment. So that a dissenting judgment sometimes results in a debate that then becomes part of the narrative later. So you can have that in a single challenge, but not on an Article 26 reference. There must be one decision. In 60 days.
No pressure. Anyway, so if people are listening to this and they're saying, obviously the legislative part is quite important, but then we always hear it the whole time that people are saying, why do we really need a president? Are they not just a glorified ambassador up in the park? And could we not, having a Taoiseach and a Taoiseach and a cabinet and an attorney general, could we not just have that?
Well, why do we want it in our constitution? I suppose, you know, that's the first answer I give you. It was decided by those who drafted this constitution that we would have a president. We had a president of a slightly different form under the 1922 constitution who replaced, as it were, the crown, the governor general. So it was a different role because in that constitutional order, all laws came from the crown down through the president to the people. Whereas we've opted to have a constitution now where we have a president who is part of the legislature, in other words, the lawmaking body, but who has no lawmaking functions.
Yes.
None at all. No policymaking functions, no executive functions, no lawmaking functions. The American president, the French president, they are quite different. Is it a good office? It's for the people of Ireland to decide. There have been the occasional, as you know, constitutional review bodies, and nobody has recommended that we remove the office of president.
Mm. Are there any significant powers the president does have that maybe have never been exercised or the people wouldn't otherwise know about?
Well, the president can refuse to dissolve the Dáil if the president feels that the Taoiseach doesn't have the confidence of the Dáil. There have been several times when it was thought that that power would be exercised, but it never did happen. It's obviously tricky, and it involves a situation where the president is satisfied that a different person could lead government, a different government could be found, could be formed. How the president exercises that power is purely discretionary power, in fact, but how it exercises that power and remains above the political fray is, again, complicated, as I said. I mean, nobody pretends this is easy. Nobody thinks that the role of the president in regard to that power to dissolve the Dáil is easy. But we have those powers. We have a lot of ceremonial powers from the president. So people actually quite like those. They quite like the idea that the newly elected Taoiseach goes out to the Oras and gets their seal of office. And so it's the marking, the ceremonial marking of the importance of the office. And certainly judges too go to the Oras and they get their warrant of office. And again, that's the marking of the importance of the office, that you go and get that piece of paper or that seal of office from the president. So they are effectively the powers, and they're important, but they're not lawmaking. And I suppose that's the important thing that people need to think.
So I suppose as a final question, I'm left wondering, in the way that you said that the presidency has changed since really Mary Robinson onwards, and a lot of people would say Michael Dee changed the role quite a bit over the last 14 years. Is there more scope within the constitution, within the office, for a new president, whoever that is, to shape it more to themselves, to make it become a more 21st century thing and be a little bit different? Or are they quite constrained by the rules of the office?
They're constrained in what they can do. And it's you, in fact, who said to me, are they not? They're constrained in what they can do, but not so constrained in what they can say. I mean, that I think is that's what the narrative is in some of the academic writing. And in a sense, every president has brought their personality to the role. Every president, including the silent De Valera that I remember when I was a child. But other presidents have brought different personalities to the role. You could say that the last three presidents have brought ideals to the role. They've brought perhaps cultural ideals to the role, not party politics, but rights discourse to the role. And the Supreme Court did actually refer to the fact that presidents have promoted, I quote from the judgment, recent presidents have promoted the causes of diversity, innovation, encouragement of the science of arts, the public, the president advances the common good, expresses the ideals of democracy or the ideals of good neighborliness at home and at an international level. These functions are not decision-making or policy-making functions, but operate at a constitutional level and as a reflection of domestic values and principles. So every president, whoever it might be, will bring that reflection. But I think it wouldn't possibly be correct to say that the president is going to fly his or her own flag out there. They've been elected by direct election by the people of Ireland, and whoever it is will have to be a reflection of that value, of the values of the people, but perhaps also, because reflections do that, push back to the people of Ireland the discourse. And what discourse do you want to have? What values do you want to reflect? What ideals do you want the new president to have or Ireland to have? What are your ideals or your hopes? And that, I suppose, is, insofar as I've given an answer to your question, that's in a sense the answer, which is it's not a personality, but it might be a way of thinking and a way of acting and a way of speaking in the thinking and acting. So different presidents, as the Supreme Court has said, have taken different approaches to that.
Justice Mary Baker, thank you so much for chatting to us on the Let Me Explain podcast. That was fascinating and gives people, I think, a lot to think about now as they head towards October 24th and polling day. Thank you so much again. And we will chat to you next week on the podcast.
Hey, football fans, Drew Brees here. Kroger Play and Owner's Box have teamed up for the next generation of daily fantasy sports. First-time players can get $25 in free entries, plus 250 fuel points. And you can score all season long with 2x the fuel points for every dollar spent to use at Kroger Fuel Centers. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER.
Void where prohibited. Eligibility restrictions apply. 18 plus in most eligible states, but age varies by jurisdiction. Offer is valid between 8-6-25 and 1-5-26. Terms apply. See full terms and conditions at ownersbox.com/footballfuelpointstc.